I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. Before we get to this edition of the show, I just want to promote Wall Street Window, a website maintained by Mike Swanson that provides valuable insights on both financial markets and geopolitics. It's been around since 2003, and its slogan is "Be in the Know," and I highly recommend it as daily reading. So go on over to wallstreetwindow.com and keep yourself informed. This edition of Parallax Views is brought to you by the $10 and above tier supporters of Parallax Views on Patreon. So, with that in mind, producers credit shoutouts to Gunner, Mark, Alexander, Catherine, Tilo, Emilia, Jeff, John, Bert, Brian, Elliot, Michael, Brace, Nick,
Meresham,
Galen, Arlen, Beau,
Christopher, Michael,
Gigadelic Media, Chance, Chase, Dan,
David H, Y Kellerman, Saadad 13,
Kathleen, David,
Ava,
Bob,
The West Bank Robbery Podcast,
Jamie,
Enoch,
Gary,
Max,
Ishtofer, James, Martin, Matthew Ho,
Brian,
Nobody, Thomas, and Dano. And now on to the show.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. I've got a triple feature edition of the show today. Later on, we'll be talking to Richard Silverstein of the Tikkun Olam blog, which covers the Israeli national security state. And we'll also be talking with Chris Habibi of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee. But first, Mel Burr, staff writer at The Real News, returns to discuss what she saw at the UCLA Gaza protests. Let's get right to it with Mel. Welcome back to Parallax Views. A guest that I haven't had on in a while, but you know, I always enjoy the conversation with her when she can stop by. She's a staff writer at The Real News, Mel Burr. How are you doing?
I'm good. Yeah, it's been what? Almost 5 years, maybe? Since we've, it's been a long time.
I think I had you on when we were talking about that Protean magazine. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was still in grad school then. Hot damn. Hello. Welcome. Yay. It's good to be here. It's good to talk to you about some pretty important stuff. So
you've been reporting on the protests in Southern California and in particular at UCLA. One thing I wanted to hit upon first is, you know, we're seeing all this news about the protests, and the protest movement, but something I'm not seeing covered much is the fact that, you know, these students do have actual demands. I don't know if you can talk a little bit about what their demands are.
Yeah. So the UCLA students, like any of the campus occupations that have been happening over the last couple of weeks, have some pretty clear demands. The first two is that they are asking the University of California, specifically UCLA, to disclose and divest from any of the major ties that they may have with essentially the war machine, right? So a lot of these universities, UCLA among them, do have sort of relationships that are sort of reciprocal relationships between arms manufacturers, manufacturers like Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Elbit Systems, you know, these groups that are making bombs that the U.S. is then sending to foreign countries to drop on places like Palestine. So students clearly, they pay tuition to go to these universities, and they don't want their tuition to go towards killing people. And that's been a clear sort of demand from the start. Other demands that UCLA students have are boycotting policing, boycotting academia that directly has relationships with the Israeli government or Israeli universities. There are programs in place at UCLA that are sort of like exchange programs. So all of these things are things that the students, through their encampment, really wanted to draw attention to and try and pressure the university to divest themselves from.
So right now I'm in like the heart of, unfortunately, like the heart of Trump territory. I feel like I'm in Florida right now. So I have to hear people whenever I go out telling me, oh, those campus protesters. So I want to know, what would you say to people that are only taking in the sort of junk food news and the attacks on these protesters by various news organizations right now? What would you want to say to people that may be listening that are getting the wrong impression about the protests?
First and foremost, most of these encampments, if not all of these encampments, are not in place to engender a culture of violence on these campuses, right? You see many folks showing videos, talking about their experiences among these encampments, and my own experience seeing the encampment come up last week on the first day, is that these are spaces where students are doing homework, they're sharing food, they're holding community with one another. They have libraries, they have peer support spaces, they have workshops. I mean, all you have to do is look at a daily schedule for any one of these encampments. And what you're seeing are skill shares. You're seeing open conversations about the Israeli occupation of Palestine. You're seeing really the space to be kind of welcome to have your thoughts changed about it, right? And I think it's really important to note that these students are smart. They're brilliant. They know what they're doing. They have a clear sort of idea about what they're trying to do in these spaces. And the mainstream media has chosen, as tends to happen, as we know, if it bleeds, it leads. So you see more and more of these conversations around the police repression of these encampments and less about what they were there for in the first place, which is natural in a country like this one. And it's part of the story, right? As you know, that was sort of my entrance into the wider conversation about what's going on at UCLA, is seeing the violence that has happened as a result of counter protesters' assault on these encampments, right? But that's the clear piece there, is standing in solidarity with Palestinians, standing in solidarity with Palestinian workers who have, over the last 6 months and even before the last many years, have asked for this, have begged, have pleaded for this, for anyone to acknowledge their humanity in the face of wholesale destruction.
When did you first arrive at the protests in UCLA, and what happened on April 30th? Because things got very crazy.
Yeah. So myself and a fellow reporter, Joey Scott, who I have worked with for a number of years with the IWW, we had seen some social media posts after Columbia's massive police response to the students occupying Hind Hall, asking for folks to kind of shore up the encampment at UCLA, especially because the university had declared that the encampment was an unauthorized assembly on the campus, which was a change in rhetoric from the last 5 days prior to that. So we just went to go and be there, try to make more inroads with the encampment protesters, students rather, and really just kind of see what the situation was so soon after Columbia's police nightmare. And we got there around, I would say, 10 o'clock. And we kind of posted ourselves up at a barricade that was, that gave us a vantage point of the quad, where on one side you had the barricades and the encampment. And then on the other side, across a wide sidewalk, you had the counter protest that was happening, which was also behind its own set of barricades. And this middle, no man's land in the middle, was staffed by security and various other campus authorities, I guess you could say. And we were just standing there for, oh, I don't know, probably about 30 to 45 minutes. They were, the counter protesters were playing loud music on repeat. They were playing recordings of children crying.
That's playing some psychological warfare tactics there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Their goal very clearly was to make it difficult for these students to sleep. And to their credit, these students were listening to, I guess, what was the Israeli version of Baby Shark? I'm not sure. It's a, whatever it was on repeat and it had a beat. And so they were dancing to it. And I don't think that made the pro-Israel folks very happy. But that was pretty much what it was for about 45 minutes. And then closer to 11, the pro-Israel side got into some sort of argument with the security and then began dismantling the barricades very quickly. And, you know, there were about 150 to 250 counter-protesters there. And they pulled those barricades apart really quickly and then made a beeline for the encampment barricades. They ripped down flags. They started ripping apart the wood slats that and pallets that had been set up. And that began what was like three and a half hours of just a constant assault on these students to try and enter their encampment and do more damage than what they were already doing.
I've heard that these counter protesters were yelling things like second Nakba. And also I know there was use of fireworks, right?
Mm-hmm. I did not hear that particular phrase being said, but again, I was from a vantage point that was quite far away from where folks were pulling apart the fences. Myself, I stood up on the stairs just to get a better sense of what was going on and took multiple videos of the pro-Israel counter-protesters firing large artillery shells, fireworks directly into the encampment. They were exploding at knee level. There are reports that it lit some of the tents on fire, which is not surprising. I mean, it was scary. It was very scary. And I know that because of those fireworks, at least one student was injured as a result of that. And many more were injured because they were hit with pieces of metal barricade. They were hit with, parts of pallets that had been ripped apart. Folks were dragged out from behind the encampment barricade and beaten by multiple individuals. Yeah, it was not great to watch.
So did you go back to UCLA the next day? And what was the feelings for the protesters that day after? They seemed like a pretty resilient bunch.
You know, I didn't go back to the encampment the next day, but there are, you know, my colleagues did, and there are a lot of videos on social media that really kind of show that the community rallied in the aftermath of the mob. You know, you can see videos of what looks like thousands of individuals who dropped off donations, who wanted to shore up the borders of the encampment, and who ultimately stayed through the night to try and defend it against a wholesale police assault that took place through the night into the next morning.
So I know you weren't there for that, but what can you tell us about that incident with the police that came after?
Yeah, so the police showed up the night before in the midst of the mob continuing their assault. They formed a skirmish line and they stood there for at least 45 minutes to an hour. And they watched as the remaining crowd, of which there were still over 100 people, continued trying to get into the encampment. They watched as they ripped people out from behind the walls of the encampment and beat the crap out of them. They stood there amassing more cops. No one tried to intervene at that time. And anyone who was not a police officer who tried to intervene and carry injured people away from the violence were themselves injured. After about an hour, the police moved in, cleared away the counter protesters, notably arrested no one, and then maintained a presence there through the entire next day. Around 7 o'clock the next day, individuals, of which there were, God, there had to have been at least 1,000 people there, trying to defend the encampment, got to see multiple police agencies show up. The multiple police agencies staged buses and command centers throughout the day and evening. And then apparently around 1 a.m. or so, they began raiding the encampment. And it took them until 6 a.m., almost 7 a.m., the sun had come up, to finish what they were doing. And ultimately, the encampment occupation was lost. 135 people, students, faculty, and others were arrested. At least 5 students received head injuries from police firing, quote, less lethal rounds, rubber-tipped bullets at their heads. They left the encampment in ruins. They damaged all the tents after the sweep and shoved everyone's belongings into a dumpster. There are reports that some of the students who were told that they could not grab their things and take them with them when they were arrested would be able to go back to the encampment and grab them the next day. All of that got shoved into a dumpster and no one was allowed to pick through the wreckage to find their things. So folks lost keys, wallets, computers, textbooks, that kind of stuff.
So it's been a rather tumultuous past few weeks. I mean, we've seen 2 senators, Josh Hawley and Tom Cotton, calling for what I would say amounts to vigilante violence against activists and protesters. I mean, I've seen people call for the National Guard to be brought in. And, you know, we're literally a day away from the anniversary of Kent State. So I'm shocked that people would actually, you know, call in the National Guard. Have we learned nothing from history? And then we have this speech yesterday by Joe Biden. What did you make of that?
What was the tenor of the speech? It was, you know, there can be dissent, but there shouldn't be disorder. Dissent cannot lead to disorder, which is kind of a rich statement coming from a country that was founded on both of those principles through violent revolution. The thing that I want to say is, you know, there's been a number of sort of parallel anniversaries that have happened this last week, 56 years to the day, Columbia had its campus raided by the NYPD to arrest and end a building occupation. And, you know, that was its main purpose, was to draw attention to a really, really horrible war. We are coming up on the anniversary of Kent State, and we have seen video and photos of multiple campuses, including UCLA, posting snipers on the roof of their academic buildings. To see Joe Biden release formal statements that says that this very robust student anti-war movement is not changing his thoughts and his plans about how he treats this conflict, if you want to call it that, this war, this genocide in the Middle East any differently, is not a surprise. It's significant because the Democratic Party spends a lot of time really trying to push for these sort of progressive values, and would likely use that progressivism and that progressive ideology as a bargaining chip or sort of strategy in their election campaigns had it been a GOP president. I mean, we saw it in 2020 and before that. But the thing here is that the student anti-war movement as a movement presents a very real threat to the sort of day-to-day movements of the U.S. government and the sort of American global hegemony, for the last many decades, right? And what the American empire in all of its sort of machinations looks like. We've seen this in pretty much every student movement that's come up in response to a sort of shitty policy by the United States government. It's in the last century, you know. And as always, students are really kind of at the vanguard of either a shifting sort of eruption or change in the sort of prevailing thinking about a particular conflict or issue, or to put it simply, they've always been right, you know. And these students are no different. And these universities are quick to try and quell this dissent because the relationship with the military-industrial complex, with the Israeli government, with the United States government, is sort of all enmeshed. These endowments, you know, they receive grants, funds, federal funding. They receive donors who work in these industries, alumni who are supporters of these industries. All of these things come together, and it forms a very large chunk of the money that they take in, that allows it, you know, the university to operate in such a way, either as landlord or as job creator or as profit creator. And when you have groups of these students drawing attention to those relationships, some of which are not even made clear to the public, they are sort of obscured intentionally, the sort of filings and the various ways in which these universities have these relationships are deliberately opaque.
I was going to say in that regard, not to interrupt you, but I think that's another thing people are missing about these protests. In a way, I understand the protests are about Gaza. They're about Palestine, but they're also about much more than that. You know, they're about, you know, students demanding things like investment transparency. And they are, I mean, these protests are challenging, you know, the militarized police that we've been seeing since, you know, 9/11. It's challenging the neoliberalism of the academy. I think it's challenging a lot of things all at once.
I would have to agree, but you also have to remember that these relationships with the state of Israel are often complex. And I don't mean to say that as like a way to distract from the conversation we're having, but you have to know that, you know, we know, and it has been known that police departments across the United States have been trained by or worked with the IDF in the past. So you see this hyper-militarization, and I think students are drawing a line between those agencies and how that works, right? We're seeing much of the same sort of tactics being used by American police that are that have been used against Palestinians during the long decades of occupation. And, you know, students are right to say that with these institutions of higher education, many of them prestigious and very rich institutions, a lot of the issues begin and end in these academies, right? And if the academy is willing and able and courageous and right and moral and just enough to divest themselves from the continuation of these relationships, maybe we can get back to what higher education is supposed to be for, which is, you know, debate, creation of knowledge, the collation of knowledge and the curation of subsequent generations of informed, educated voters, people, workers, you know, philosophers, so on. So, you know, I will say, having been to a number of these encampments in Southern California and having spoke to a lot of these young folks, because yes, they are young. They're 18, 19, 20, 21. These are the best and brightest of the American future, frankly. They know what they're doing. They understand the stake that they have in this, and they understand the great personal risk that they are undertaking in order to fight for this cause, which is Palestinian liberation, which is a stop to the consistent war industrial machinery that churn out weapons of mass violence to be dropped on countries in the global South. You know, do not underestimate what they're doing, and do not underestimate who they are and their understanding of their place in this movement.
Before closing out, is there anything else you want to say maybe about where you see this movement and these encampments going forward? Because I do think they're already showing signs of a little bit of success. I know certain universities have basically agreed to at least some of the demands already. I'd have to pull up a list of the news stories concerning universities that have negotiated with the encampments. But I know there's already been cases where some unis have, caved to these demands. They've given in to the demands. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, so universities like Brown University have made commitments to continue divestment negotiations at the start of the next semester. I will tell you, and there are others that have done the referendums, put it to the vote for the student body and the faculty, and those referendums have said, yes, we will divest, right? So, there's a number of different things that are happening here. Some universities really are willing to negotiate and put a distinct foot forward in divesting from these various war systems, rather. I will say that some universities, due to occupations that happened last semester after October 7th, at places like Occidental College here in Los Angeles, they had made a commitment to continue those negotiations with student representatives to disclose and divest from Israel or from systems like, Lockheed Martin or so on, and deliberately sort of drag those negotiations on until they had enough of flagging interest or whatever you want to call it to kind of just let them fall away from the wayside. So at encampments like Occidental College, where some of their demands were met when they occupied an administration building last semester, the college decided not to divest, right? So the occupation the encampment that is happening now is a sort of conversation about, we're here to finish the job because you said you were going to do it and you haven't done it. Right. So I think in terms of what we see in the future is, and we're already seeing this, is a, continued pressure campaign that isn't stalled by summer break, that is picked back up in the fall when classes begin again, that says that you made this promise, we're holding you to it. Now, what that looks like, it could mean encampments continue in the fall. It could mean other occupations. It could mean boycotts of student events. I mean, it just depends on each individual campus's process here. One thing else I would say is that we've already kind of seen what happens, what is happening on a regularity, what happens when the police break up the encampments, what happens when the university starts suspending students. The encampments get dismantled. They find another place to post up. And I think having that sort of unflagging energy to rebuild when things are torn down and to bring in more energy when the police try to repress this is paramount to the success of this movement. And to also try to think of ways within the sort of civil disobedience, within the sort of nonviolence, to escalate this pressure campaign. And that's going to look different wherever you go. All I can say about the wider sort of anti-war movement in response to the U.S.'s involvement in the genocide in Palestine is that we all kind of are looking on the horizon to the DNC, the RNC, the election, and then into next year, right? The anniversary of J6, the anniversary of J20, the inauguration, and so on, as potential flashpoints for this movement to coalesce more, to present a more unified front against the administrations that are sending billions to Israel and to other countries to continue their bombing campaigns. And so it feels like we're sort of at the start of another sustained eruption here in the United States. And what that looks like and how that plays out, you and I are both just going to be witness to it. You know what I mean?
Right,
I'm not going to try.
I feel at the very least we're in the, I think we've seen a large generational shift on these issues, specifically Palestine, because, you know, a lot of younger people I know do not hold the views of their elders on this. And I do think they're challenging a lot of views that have long been held in the U.S. with regards to Israel-Palestine.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I think that they're building on the significant work that the BDS movement has been doing in the last many, in a couple of decades, right? And they're building on the legacy that was cemented into American history for, you know, protests against South African apartheid, for example. And going back even farther, the Vietnam anti-war movement. And they're building upon these lessons learned, and they're using those as the springboard to move forward in their own organizing. It's extremely disciplined. It's full of rage, but it's also full of solidarity. It's full of optimism. And it's been, you know, truly something to behold. And really, the future is bright with these folks in it. And I'm grateful to do my part to try and tell this story as accurately as possible and to give whatever I can in terms of a, I don't know, a platform with my 10,000 followers on Twitter, to be able to showcase the work that's being done and to contribute to that movement. So,
can I ask you one last thing? I promise to let you go after this. We've
sure.
already went a little bit over. What's the response been to the journalism you've been doing on this? Because I'm sure you get a lot of hate mail, but I'm also sure you get a lot of love from people that appreciate what you're doing.
About 50-50. I mean, you always get folks who are emboldened by their anonymity on the internet telling you to go F yourself, you know, in your DMs, and you just delete the messages and move on. You know, I've had a lot of people send me messages of thanks to say, you know, thanks for being there to cover this accurately. You know, I'm doing what I can to counter narratives by mainstream media outlets, as well as many of the brilliant independent journalists and, you know, independent nonprofit outlets that exist in LA and beyond. We're all doing our best to kind of tell the story as openly as possible, and to not give in to profit-enforced propaganda that many of these 24-hour news networks engage in, for all their faults and for all their virtues. So, you know, as always, this is sort of a war of messaging as much as it is, you know, something that's more material. And, you know, I do my best. I do my best to do this accurately and with integrity and with empathy, you know. That's really what I'm trying to do. And I'm, as always, trying to make sure that the story is about the people that I'm talking to and not about me, you know. And I hope that folks who listen or folks in these encampments who are seeing this work find it to be useful and appreciate it, because that's who I'm doing it for. So,
well, hey, thanks again, Mel, for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners keep up with the work and the work you're doing at The Real News?
Yeah. So you can follow me on my personal Twitter. It's Mel_Buer, Buer. You can also listen to the Real News Network podcast, which I host somewhat regularly. And then I also have articles up on the Real News. I'm doing more writing these days, which is great. And I have a lot of really incredible stories coming up here in the next couple of weeks and months. And, you know, we're working on getting teams out to the DNC. So you'll be able to see the organizing and the movement that's built up in Chicago in August. So
that's great. Thanks again.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Next up, Chris Habibi of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee. joins us to discuss the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act bill that just passed in Congress. Many voices, foremost among them Palestinian and Arab Americans, say the bill conflates criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism in a way that is dangerous. Additionally, even conservative voices like Sarab Amari of Compact Magazine and, believe it or not, Matt Walsh of The Daily Wire have been critical of the bill on free speech grounds. And those voices on the conservative end of things are not necessarily anti-Israel. I definitely would say Sarab is not an anti-Israel voice. So there's a lot going on with this bill, and there's a lot of critiques that are being made about it, both on the right and the left. So without any further ado, let's get right to it with Chris Habibi of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest that I'm really happy to have on. He works for an organization that I have a lot of respect for, Chris Habibi, National Government Affairs and Advocacy Director of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee. How are you doing?
Doing all right. Thank you so much.
So the reason I wanted to have you on was to discuss this bill that has recently passed in Congress, the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. But before we get to that, can you just let my listeners know about what the ADC is and the work it does?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so the ADC, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, we are the nation's largest Arab American civil rights organization. We were founded in 1980 by former U.S. Senator James Eborezic, and we do work that spans civil rights advocacy all the way to advocating for students and combating stereotypes, as well as promoting and celebrating, you know, the arts, the culture, the heritage of people of Arab descent.
So if we can, let's talk about this Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. What should people know about it? You know, I think all of us are sensitive to issues of bigotry, including anti-Semitism. But this bill has some very frightening implications, especially for Palestinian, Arab, and Arab voices. So can you speak to that?
Yeah, of course. So H.R. 6090, the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, which passed the House yesterday, what it does is it requires the Department of Education, when investigating a Title VI complaint, basically that a institution that receives federal funding discriminates on the basis of race, color, national origin, that they are required to consider what's called the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's working definition of anti-Semitism when investigating these complaints. Now, what is probably the most problematic piece of this is that definition. We like to refer to it as the IRA definition. And what it does is it conflates criticism of the state of Israel, the government of Israel, with anti-Semitism. It conflates anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. And you can see this in the examples that they give as what would be considered anti-Semitism under this definition. 7 of those 11 examples are basically there to protect the state of Israel from accountability, from criticism. So now, if this passes the Senate, if this becomes law, what will happen is that the Department of Education will be forced to consider this conflation when determining if a school, college, university is discriminating against students on the basis of race, color, or national origin.
What can be done now? Because for me, I just think this is like deeply frightening in terms of being a free speech issue because, you know, I mean, conflating criticism of Israel or criticism of Zionism with anti-Semitism, I think that can lead us down some dangerous paths. And even the drafter of the IHRA working definition, Kenneth Stern, has said that he's worried about this being weaponized and used in this legal context. He was saying that back in 2019. So how can we stand up to this? Because, you know, we've seen it pass through the House.
Now it's going to have to go through the Senate. What do you think people need to know, and what can they do?
Well, first, call your senators. ADC has put out an action tool for folks to be able to email both of their senators directly. All you have to do is put in your information so that we can make sure that you get the email gets to the right senators. I think driving calls, messages is the best way to let them know that you don't agree with it. And you're absolutely right to point out that the chief drafter, Kenneth Stern, is opposed to this. He's made it very clear that that working definition was never intended to be used in any sort of criminal or policy fashion. And he's even advocated on the state level against efforts to implement and adopt the IHRA definition on the state level.
In the action alert that was released by ADC earlier today, there was talk of some of the other legislation going through Congress right now being considered in Congress. Can you speak to those pieces of legislation? Let's hone in on what you think the most important ones are.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that outside of the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, the most important one, and I'm going to quickly make sure that I have the correct bill number, because this bill actually doesn't even have a title. But what it does is it directs, it allows for a single government official to, because they disagree with any nonprofit tax exempt organization, disagrees with their views, that that person can then revoke the tax exempt status of that organization simply by claiming that they are a terrorist supporting organization. Now, this bill has already passed the House. It's in the Senate. And that bill number is 6408, so H.R. 6408. And like the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, I have also put out an action tool for that one, because it threatens, right now it's threatening organizations like ADC, like American Muslims for Palestine, like Jewish Voice for Peace, like National Students for Justice in Palestine. And that's not an assumption, that's not, reading between the lines. In the hearing where they were voting on this in the House, the bill's proponent actually called out Students for Justice in Palestine. So it's not an assumption that this is why they're pushing for this bill and who they're targeting. But in a different administration, I'll say, if Secretary of Treasury decides they don't like a tax-exempt organization because they're advocating for progressive policies, There's nothing in that bill that would prevent them from deciding that they are a terrorist supporting organization. And so it's crucial, because the work, especially of tax exempt nonprofits, is essential. We're the ones that are able to educate the public in a nonpartisan, in a sectarian way that no other organizations can. So that is probably the most dangerous bill outside of the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act that is currently in the process, that's passed at least one house. Now, the other two bills that we highlighted in our email was H.R. 7921, which is the Countering Anti-Semitism Act. Now, this one was being pushed by Democrats in the House as somewhat of an alternative to the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. This one creates a task force and a national coordinator based around the Biden administration's national strategy for countering anti-Semitism. But it still reinforces the narrative that anyone advocating for Palestinians, for Palestinians in Gaza, opposing the genocide that's happening to Palestinians in Gaza, is a threat, is a danger. So even in this watered down Countering Anti-Semitism Act, we're still being demonized in a way that is terrifying.
Not to interrupt you, but can you speak to that a little bit more? Because I know I've had other guests on that have said, well, the Countering Anti-Semitism Act is good, but the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act isn't. So I was wondering if you could go more into the problems you see with the Countering Anti-Semitism Act.
Yeah. So I can understand folks that, when given the choice between the two, would prefer the Countering Anti-Semitism Act. Like I said, it creates a task force. It establishes a position of national coordinator for combating anti-Semitism. But in the end, what we're talking about now, when people talk about anti-Semitism in the United States, I say people, when politicians talk about anti-Semitism in the United States, what they're referring to is the Palestinian Solidarity Movement. And so while this doesn't require the Department of Education to implement this horrifically anti-Palestinian definition when investigating Civil Rights Act complaints, it still reinforces and boosts the narrative that as a Palestinian, I can't talk about the issues that are important to me, can't talk about my family's history, can't call out the genocide that is happening.
And then you said there was the second bill, H.R. 7914?
Yes. And so that one is the Accountability for Terrorist Perpetrators of October 7th Act, which... Hey, like with most of these bills, between 6090, between the tax exempt nonprofit bill, a lot of this is just duplicative of existing law. So what this bill does is it says that if you are a member of what they call the Palestinian Resistance Committee, so basically every Palestinian liberation organization. Beyond, and it goes beyond just the named ones that are designated terrorist organizations, you know, the Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And it goes beyond that. It's in a very broad, general way that is really scary. And it says that you can't come to the United States. It's focused on immigration, but again, terrorists deemed by the United States government are already not allowed to come to the United States. So what it does is it broadens what could be considered a terrorist to a point where any Palestinian could, in theory, be deemed a terrorist and not allowed to come to the United States, which is especially when people are fleeing for their lives under the threat of genocide in Gaza, under the threat of settler violence and state-supported settler violence in the West Bank, not allowing Palestinians to leave if they want to, is just unconscionable.
I just had one or two more questions. And the first is, this is more broad and outside of just talking about these pieces of legislation. But, you know, I feel like a lot of Americans don't really understand, not just Palestinians, but Arab Americans. I mean, for instance, I think, you know, Arab Americans and Palestinian Americans, it's, you know, it's not one and the same. You know, you could be a Palestinian American, but that doesn't, not all Arab Americans are Palestinian Americans. You know, I think a lot of people also don't realize there's Christian Palestinians. You know, I've had people say to me, I thought all Palestinians were Muslim. And also we've had years of, you know, garbage media out there, including, you know, like old Chuck Norris movies that push this line that all Palestinians, all Arabs are, you know, just like these monstrous, violent terrorists. So people have had a lot of propaganda shoved down their throats, and especially after 9/11, what do you think the biggest misunderstandings America has about Arab and Palestinian people?
I think that there is such a diversity within our communities, both religiously. You know, I'm a Palestinian Christian, but there's the Palestinian Sunni, Palestinian Shia. There's Arabs from across the region. And each one has their own unique, beautiful culture and heritage. But what we're all united by is our Arab ethnicity. And you're right, there has been in the media, the stereotypes. And that's something that, you know, that's actually one of the reasons that ADC was founded. In the late 1970s, 1980, the FBI ran this thing called Abscam, where they dressed up FBI agents in, you know, the full Arab dress and walked into Congress with briefcases full of cash to try and get to get congressmen to take bribes. And after Senator Abarezek saw that, he immediately said, no, this is not okay. This is not what should be considered okay in the United States of America. And we need an organization dedicated to defending and promoting people of Arab descent. I would also say to folks that think that, you know, Arab Americans and Arabs in the United States is somewhat of a new phenomenon, you know, coming out of the passage of the Immigration and Nationality Act in the 60s. Arabs have been in this country since before it was even a country. The first Arab to die in service of the United States died in 1775 fighting for the Revolutionary Army. The first Arab American, first American jet ace. So the jet ace is a fighter pilot that has taken down five enemy planes in a dogfight. The first one was an Arab American, was a Lebanese American. So we have been here. We have been defending this country, supporting this country for since before it was a country. And so anyone that wants to otherize us to say, you know what, they're not really American, they just came here, is missing our entire history.
I also have to ask, you know, a few months ago, I was going to have on a guest from the Council on American Islamic Relations, and they had to pull out at the last minute because they had received a bomb threat. We hear a lot about anti-Semitic incidents happening right now. I want to know, though, about the threats to Arab Americans right now, because I know you guys monitor that, and I don't think it's covered nearly enough in the media.
No, absolutely. I mean,
I'm assuming it's spiked intensely too since October. Yeah.
Oh, it absolutely has. You know, ADC has had to, we've hired an additional staff attorney. We've brought on legal fellows just to keep up with the caseload. And, you know, with each new facet, now it's, we're getting a lot of complaints and cases from students. But right after October 7th, you know, there was the stabbing of Wadia al-Fayoumi in Chicago, who was killed for being Palestinian. There was the three Palestinian students in Burlington that got shot for walking down the street wearing the keffiyeh, the Palestinian scarf. And all throughout these last 7 months, you know, we have seen conferences get canceled because of threats. Just vitriol, the employment issues. We just, ADC last week held a Know Your Rights webinar with the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission to help educate our community on what their rights are, because we have just received an overwhelming amount of intakes, to the point where we're collaborating with other organizations like CARE, like Palestine Legal, to be able to handle just the amount of cases that are coming in.
I was going to say real quick, I'm glad you mentioned the conferences being shut down, because, you know, even this past November, a lot of people didn't know about it, but I heard about it because I'm in Florida. The Connect Arab America Empowerment Summit in Orlando was canceled at the DoubleTree Hilton Hotel. And I believe it was over threats. So, I mean, it's gotten very bad. And I think people need to know that. In closing, I did want to ask you just briefly here. We've talked about the problems with this legislation that has gone through Congress. For people that are legitimately concerned about the issue of anti-Semitism, what do you think are some ways that anti-Semitism can be legitimately combated? And do you think there's issues that American Jews and Arab Americans can work on together? Because I think they face a lot of threats from, you know, the sort of MAGA movement and the Trump movement.
Yeah. Well, you hit the nail on the head. The threat that we're seeing is it's based in white supremacy. It's based in this jingoistic nationalist MAGA movement. I think that there are organizations that'll help in terms of, you know, American Jews and Arab Americans working together to combat bigotry. I think that has shown throughout the history of the civil rights movement, all the way up to today, where, you know, it's Arab and Palestinian Americans standing side by side with Jews, with Black Americans, with Latinos, with all of these marginalized communities of color, and just any marginalized community, because what any American of conscience knows is that if rising tide lifts all ships. If one of us is being threatened, being attacked, then we're all being attacked because we're all marginalized. So I sincerely hope that there are ways forward. I know that, you know, I work closely with organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace that are doing just incredible work and really are care about both combating what is, I don't want to say real anti-Semitism because that is not, it's not an accurate way to describe it, but to combat the threats that Jews are facing, but also advocating for the issues that any American, any person of conscience would advocate for.
Well, I want to thank you again, Chris Habibi, for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners keep up with the work ADC is doing?
Yeah, you visit us, ADC.org, really easy. A is an apple, D is in dog, C is in cat.org. You can sign up for our emails. Make sure you keep up to date with the action alerts that we have going. We can be found on social media at ADC National, on Instagram at ADC, on Twitter or X. Still don't know what to call it. So yeah, that's probably the best ways to make sure that you're staying abreast of what's going on.
And finally, we have Richard Silverstein of the Tikkun Olam blog, a blog tracking the Israeli national security state, back on the show to discuss a number of topics, starting with the campus protests and what he refers to as the powerful backlash alliance against those protests. All that and much more to follow in the conversation with Richard Silverstein. Let's get right to it.
Welcome back to Parallax Views, a guest that we've had on a number of times over the years. He's a bit of a fan favorite here at Parallax Views. Richard Silverstein of the Tikkun Olam blog, which covers breaking news on the Israeli national security state. How are you doing? And I always feel weird asking that question. How are you doing at a time like this when I think a lot of us are under a great deal of duress? You know, maybe not as much duress as the people being directly affected in Gaza right now, but I think what we're seeing is very heartbreaking.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very difficult. It's always difficult to write about Israel-Palestine, but right now, when the war is coming home here, that makes it even more sad and tragic with all the arrests and the violence, which we've seen the last day or two at UCLA, Columbia, and other places. It's takes a toll. You know, what I do here, combination of journalism and activism, means that you have a commitment to what you're reporting that's deeper, I think, than that of a mainstream media journalist. You're invested in the tragedy, and you're invested in trying to point to a better way forward, and you're often very sad at what you have to report.
Maybe you can give your analysis of what we've been seeing over the past few days and weeks on college campuses, because I just feel like I'm living in bizarro world right now. Because I mean, you can point out isolated incidents on campuses where maybe a student said something horrid or dumb, but we're now at this moment where there's this broad anti-activist and anti-protest rhetoric being used. I feel like we're moving towards police state America. It's horrifying.
Yeah, I think I've written that post on Twitter that my view of what's going on is that administrators in all these different universities that are bringing in the police, that are basically approving of the police engaging in violence and even assaulting and harming professors, and having the faculty really in rebellion against the administration. I just think that is the turning the campus into a police state. They're basically at Columbia not allowing faculty on campus. They're not allowing students who don't live on campus to access the campus. They're going to have NYPD on campus until May 17th, which is probably commencement. It's just an astonishing turn of events. And I think that what you're seeing is two conflicting developments here. You have the campus protest movement on the one hand, and then you have the backlash against the campus protest on another. And this is often happens when you have a social movement like Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter. I've seen the backlash against it. And the backlash consists of all of the power structures and elites that have something invested in maintaining the status quo. And so the thing about the vested elites engaging in the backlash is that it then bleeds back into the original movement and amplifies the movement, makes it more powerful, and makes it in effect more dangerous, because then you have the elites having to ratchet up their level of violence. And one thing I wanted to add here is that there is a, I call it an alliance among all of the elites. And by an alliance, I include people like the campus administrators, the police, the billionaire investors like Bill Ackman, who have a vested financial interest in the universities and in the companies that they're wanting to invest in, which have ties to the universities or may have started in universities, and also may have investments in Israeli companies, and the Israel lobby, like AIPAC, the American Jewish Committee, ADL. They all need the narrative to return to what it used to be, which was a largely pro-Israel narrative in the United States. That this narrative is threatened by what the campus students protest is doing, and they need to repress it. They need to defeat it. Oh, and I forgot one other element of the alliance, which is the MAGA Republicans in Congress. So every time you see a campus protest movement really sort of grab the spotlight, like it did at Columbia, like it did at UCLA, you'll see the president's hauled before the witch hunt kangaroo court, that is the House committee that is the Republicans' control, and they're able to haul these presidents before them. They're able to engage in what I call an inquisition against the presidents. They've gotten the presidents of Harvard and Penn have been forced out, and they brought the president of Columbia, who was craven in her obsequious or servile approach to the Congress members, which in turn enraged the students and the faculty, as I mentioned earlier. And then you have now they're going to summon the chancellor of UCLA for the same reason. So it's an ugly, ugly thing. And this this backlash and the alliance that I mentioned hasn't been covered at all in the media. No one has offered the analysis that I'm offering, which I think is very important. One other thing I wanted to go to, which is the charges by the Backlash Alliance against the protest movement, which are all of the charges are false. The student movement is not violent. The student movement is not engaged in terrorism. The student movement is not allied with Hamas, nor with Hezbollah. They are not terrorists. They are not anti-Semitic. That's even the most important thing. This movement is pro-Palestinian. This movement is against the war in Gaza. It is against genocide. There is nothing anti-Semitic in this. And there are many Jewish students who are participating in these protests. And you can see it in the media all the time. You see these Jewish protesters, Jewish Voice for Peace, some just individual students. I even read one person on Twitter said that he brought Passover, kosher for Passover food to the, I think it was University of Wisconsin encampment. So this is a movement that Jews can participate in. Now, there are charges that pro-Israel Jewish students feel threatened and feel unsafe. I can't vouch for what they're feeling, but this is a manufactured crisis. And it is, again, part of the backlash narrative that these elites are trying to impose on what is what I call their actual reality.
You know that I have a very broad range of listeners. So I know I'm going to have some listeners that are going to try to push back by saying, well, I've seen, a video where I could hear someone yelling, go back to Poland, or I saw, a picture of one individual at the protests holding a Hezbollah flag. What do you want to say to those people? Because my issue has been, you can always find at protests someone who expresses something we may not agree with. That's just the nature of decentralized protests. But taking a broad anti-activist and anti-protest stance, I mean, I think we see where that leads. It led to things like Kent State, but I want your take on this.
Well, look, they're in a protest movement that is now on 120 campuses as of yesterday. It's probably more today, with over 1,000 students across the United States arrested. This is a mass movement. They're all across this country and 10, 20 campuses internationally, globally. So, among hundreds of thousands of students on all of these campuses, will you find one who says something stupid like Israeli Jews need to go back where they came from, which is a stupid anti-Semitic canard, but we can dismiss it because the other 99.9% of all of these students not only doesn't share these views, but often you'll find that they'll tell or make this person stop what they're doing because A, it's anti-Semitic, and because B, it reflects badly, and because it will be videoed, they'll get it on video and they'll post it all over social media and they'll use it against the student movement. But we have to keep our mind, keep our attention on what is it, the issue. And this goes back to what I was just saying. The issue is Gaza. The issue is genocide. If the Backlash Alliance can focus attention on violence and call the protests anti-Semitic, then they can take the focus away from Gaza, which is what they ultimately need to do in order to preserve the pro-Israel narrative. They have to discredit it. They have to smear it in any way that they can. And that's one of the reasons, if you look at UCLA, if you look at the pro-Israel riot by outsiders, by the way, they're talking about the campus movement being fueled by outside agitators. That's what the mayor of New York said.
This
Well,
is
who?
basically a way of saying, oh, the Iranians are behind it, or some such.
Yeah, Hezbollah, Hamas. I mean, that's what, by the way, Jonathan Greenblatt, the CEO of the ADL, has said that literally, I'm quoting him verbatim, that the Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace are campus proxies of Hezbollah. Let that sink in. Campus proxies of Hezbollah. First of all, that's libelous because he knows it's false, and that's one of the criteria of libel. The second of all, it's completely ridiculous. Hezbollah has made no statements at all about the student movement. Hamas, yes, has said that they feel comfortable. They not comfortable, but they feel supportive. There's in solidarity with the students, which of course the students are saying they're in solidarity with Gaza, basically. So it's completely bogus. And again, part of that alliance, if you throw enough spaghetti up on the wall, some of the strands are going to stick, and that's what they want. They want all of the strands that they're throwing up on the wall to see whether a couple of them land in the narrative that the people of the United States are hearing. If they can do that, by the way, 71% of Americans oppose Biden's approach to Gaza. To only 21% support him. They need to try to dent that 71% and peel off some of those people from the consensus against Biden. And this is what they do to try to do it. And by the way, by the stupidity and the distortion that they're introducing and the anger and hostility they're introducing, it only amplifies the student movement. So these people are strategically stupid, if I can sort of analyze their strategy, because if they handle this a different way, a quieter way, or a more behind the scenes way, they might be able to control the narrative a little bit better. But they're really feeding right into the hands of the student movement, even though the student movement is not doing anything to provoke them. But that's still the what the outcome is.
I mean, it's quite crazy, some of the things I'm seeing right now. You know, I'm seeing, you know, figures like Larry Summers come out and say, look, they're hoisting up the Hamas flag. And I'm looking at it and I'm like, that's a Palestinian flag. That's not the Hamas flag. I'm seeing right. on the Morning Joe, you know, a cop come on and saying, look at this chain we have. This is an outside agitator chain. And you can tell it's the chain that students buy for their bikes yeah. at the university. And it, right. I feel like I'm in a situation where I'm being told, don't believe your lying eyes. I mean, what?
The thing about all of this manufactured outrage, by the way, I wrote a blog post that I called, I got the concept from another academic, but he calls it campus panic, which is related to the term moral panic, sociology concept, which is that the powerful elites in society need to gin up hysteria and fear, and they choose minorities and weaker elements of society in order to bring to bear this fear and hostility, and that becomes a form of social control, so that the powerful elites can retain their control over the narrative, the social or the political narrative. And that's why the MAGA Republicans are doing what they're doing in Congress, attacking the campus protest movements. So following a little bit on what you said earlier, I think that the elements of this, the attempts to discredit, the attempts to use the bike lock as an example of whatever the misdeeds are supposed to be of the campus protest movement, I don't think it really resonates at all. I think you have the narrative that everybody sees in the media. They see it in their TV news. They read about it in their newspaper. They see the pictures of the dead Gaza children. They see the pictures of the refugees, the million refugees that are now in Rafah waiting for an Israeli invasion. That's much more powerful, much more graphic, much more intense. The reaction to it is much more intense than any of the stupid things that they're saying, including the charges of anti-Semitism and whatever. If you don't back up your charges, whatever they might be, with evidence, with arguments that are credible, then nobody takes you seriously. You can throw up all the strands of spaghetti you want on the wall, but they'll all fall down because you're not offering anything that anyone sees as credible. So I think that's where they stand. The only thing that's going to save them is commencement, which is ironic because they're not letting the students on campus. They're not letting many of them finish their courses and graduating. Because, by the way, they're expelling all of the students who took over Hamilton Hall, where, by the way, I was my dorm for a year when I was at Columbia. But those students who took over the hall, 100 of them were arrested. They're expelled from Columbia, not suspended. They're expelled from Columbia. So what will happen is that, and this isn't something that I'm saying that I support, but if the university administrators were smart, they would just realize, well, commencement's coming in 2 or 3 weeks. All we have to do is let the campus simmer, not provoke anything, and just live with it for 2 or 3 weeks, and the students will be going home. And they hope that the students will not be taking this movement back to their home communities, which they very well might, and continuing the protest movement in that way. But the backlash is so counterproductive to what they're doing. And it indicates their desperation, and it indicates their willingness to turn the campus into a police state. I mean, if you, like Columbia has, you refuse to allow faculty on campus, you refuse to allow students, graduate students, by the way, all live off campus, almost all of them, you refuse to allow them on campus, who is going to be in your classroom? No one's going to be in your classroom. You're not going to be a university. What are you there for? if you drive all of your student body and you drive all of your faculty away from the campus and just presume at some point in the future you're going to be able to get back to normal. By the way, you won't ever get back to normal. This is a threshold that they have passed. They can never go back to. Even if the student movement dies down at some point in the future, we now have a new normal. And the new normal is much more critical of Israel. And we've seen it.
You know what? These young people are not going to forget this.
Right. They're not. They're going to go back to their community. They're going to come back to campus. And if the war is still going on, the movement starts up again. But even if it doesn't, these students have been through a crucible of fire, almost literally, and they will not go back to whatever their equilibrium point was before. They will be radicalized by their experience. Their view of Gaza, their view of Israel-Palestine will be altered forever. And that will ripple out into society at large, because students are, as we know, the future of everything, the future of business, the future of academia, the future of the professional class. So they will go into those jobs and out into the world, and they will become the people who carry a message of what happened to them in college, and they will incorporate it into whatever their life is. So you look at the Gallup poll that came out about 6 months ago. It said for the first time, more Democrats are sympathetic to Palestine than they are to Israel. And so that itself, in addition, will ripple out into the American into American society. And Israel basically has lost America. The only allies they now have are pro-Israel Jews, which is becoming on its way to being a minority among American Jews because they're opposed to what's going on in Gaza. And it will also, the only other ally they have left are the Christian evangelicals. That's it. And everyone else is either going to become pro-Palestine, anti-Israel, or at the least willing to be much more critical of Israel. And so they've lost. And if they haven't lost right now, they're going to be losing slowly, incrementally over the course of the near future.
I was going to say, I know you're a critic of a lot of people that describe themselves as liberal Zionists, but even some liberal Zionists I've met have started to be like, I'm not liking the direction Netanyahu is taking this. So I am seeing there is a shift going on, I think, just more generally with the public. You know, I wanted to tell a story real quick, and then this will segue into the issue of the bill that just passed in Congress, the very scary bill. You know, we often hear about, oh, look at this anti-Semitic incident that happened involving at a Palestinian event. And it's usually like one person, right? You know, I've been to Palestinian events before, and I've actually seen weirdo right-wing anti-Semites try to infiltrate those events. You know, the type of right-wingers that talk about anti-Semitic tropes like Zog. And I've literally seen Palestinians say, I don't want to have anything to do with that. At one event, I even, you know, met one of these right-wingers, and they said, ah, these people are too liberal for me. See, but that doesn't get reported in the press. Yeah. When, you know, anti-Semitism is rejected by Palestinian solidarity movement people, because I guess that's not juicy enough for people or the media. But I've seen it personally, anti-Semitism be rejected at these events. And that leads me into this issue of the bill that just passed in Congress, the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. What do you make of this? Because I think this could be very dangerous.
Yeah, let me get back to that. I want to give you two small anecdotes going back to what you said originally in this question that you were asking me. And that is, there was pro-Israel people on social media found a guy who is a Christian nationalist. And they said, he's outside the gates of Columbia, and this is what the student movement is. Well, A, he's a Christian nationalist. He's a neo-Nazi, basically. And he wasn't outside the gates of Columbia. He was somewhere else. And he wasn't in the student protest movement. And that was totally discredited. So, again, it's another strand of spaghetti. Throw it up on the wall. It dropped down because everybody just ridiculed that charge. And another thing, I've been participating in Seattle, here in Seattle, protests. And I noticed at one protest, there was someone who held up a banner, not a banner, but a poster. And it showed Bibi Netanyahu and Joe Biden. And they were dressed in the Nazi sort of uniforms of Mussolini and Hitler. And just their faces were, you know, and then the uniform was below. I looked and I said, oh, my God, that is just really incredibly offensive. And I was looking around for, you know, monitors that are controlling what's going on, or safety people. And I was looking for them to go over and talk to them about it. And 30 seconds later, I looked back at the same guy. Sign was gone. I don't know what happened, but the sign disappeared. And that's as it should be. That is the people policing them, not policing, that's the wrong word, but the people controlling the narrative, controlling the message that they're giving. They themselves are inherently aware of what's anti-Semitic or what goes beyond the pale. And they are stopping those things from happening because they know it doesn't represent the movement that they've created, and that it reflects badly on them. But I don't want to say that's not the primary motive here. The primary motive is that it doesn't reflect the ideas and the values of the movement. So now let's go over to IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, I believe is what it stands for. This is a quote-unquote working definition of anti-Semitism that was created 30 or 40 years ago by a staff member at the American Jewish Committee named Kenneth Stern, who, by the way, renounces the ways in which IHRA is now being used.
Right. He's very frightened going back to even, you know, people don't realize this, but he was frightened of how it could be used legally going back to 2019 when he wrote a whole article about it. And he worked with the Nexus Task Force on anti-Semitism because they were worried. These Jewish leaders in the Nexus Task Force were worried about how this definition could be used legally against activists.
Right. He says, I mean, I don't like the IHRA. I would never have liked it even in 19, whenever it was created. I would have opposed even Kenneth Stern's involvement with it and his statements about it when it first was created. But I do appreciate him renouncing it afterwards. When he did create it, this is what he said in 2019. He said it was supposed to be a working definition, not something that would be used as a final protocol to define what anti-Semitism is and decide to take what action against anti-Semitism. So it's provisional in his mind. It wasn't meant to be a finished product. But the American Jewish Committee and all these other Israel lobby organizations, and keep in mind, these people are not concerned with anti-Semitism. They are concerned with maintaining the pro-Israel narrative. And this is yet another tool in their toolbox to try to repress legitimate speech, political speech about Israel, to repress criticism of Israel, and to make any criticism of Israel, especially anti-Zionism, especially pro-Palestine rhetoric, to make it anti-Semitic, and therefore smear it and discredit it so that it can't resonate in society. There has been a lot of pushback against this by members of Congress, and there is great doubt whether this will have to go from the House where it was passed to the Senate. And there's a lot of doubt whether the Democratic Senate wants to take this up. And I think anyone who has any contact or has had any contact with their senator who's listening should write an email to them or post on social media about IHRA and let their senator know that they oppose it, that they don't want it taken up, and that it is a suppression of speech, and it is not something that protects Jews. This is not anything to do with anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is hatred or provocation or violence against Jews. That is all it is. It has nothing to do with Israel, unless an anti-Semite wants to talk about Jews in relation to Israel and wants to blame Jews for what Israel does or for Israel's crimes. That's anti-Semitic when you single out Jews in that way. But if you are a critic of Israel and you are a supporter of Palestine, and you talk about Israel, as a nation state, and not having anything to do with Jews or Judaism, and blaming Jews for what Israel does, then you haven't engaged in anti-Semitism. And there's 11 criteria in IHRA. I can't remember the number, but four or five of them deal specifically with Israel and say, if you single out Israel as a state, then you're engaging in anti-Semitism, which is ridiculous. And there are several other points or in the definition which solely relate to Israel and really clearly are trying to stop or prevent a narrative developing that's critical of Israel.
I think the big issue with the IHRA definition, working definition, is that there's so many ambiguities in this definition. I also wanted to ask you about the events at UCLA. I mean, I'm seeing pro-Israel counter-protesters shooting rockets, like of fireworks, basically using a firework as a rocket and shooting it into the encampment. This is disturbing to me. And I also saw the video of these pro-Israel counter-protesters yelling second Nakba. Can you comment on this whole situation?
Well, they also use the N-word. They threw things like a scooter into the protest encampment. They threw fireworks. They had sticks that they were using to try to... the police had erected a barrier between the pro-Israel and the pro-Palestinian group. They tried to rip the barriers down. And by the way, I want to talk about this alliance. Go back to that. The GoFundMe account supporting the pro-Israel people at UCLA has collected $93,000. $10,000 came from Bill Ackman, who your viewers and listeners will remember was one of the key people who got Claudine Gay fired, not fired, but she was forced to resign as the president of Harvard. So Bill, the billionaire Bill Ackman, who runs Pershing Management, hedge fund, has funded the violent protests at UCLA. And Jerry Seinfeld's wife, Jessica Seinfeld, has given $5,000 to the same movement. And they use that, by the way, not just for the violence that they engaged in. They put up a huge video screen, a stadium-sized video screen, on the UCLA campus. You know, with all of the equipment that you see in stadiums at concerts, all of that metal framework, and then a huge screen, and they aired video of the 10/7 attack, the Hamas attack on Israel. And they also had this huge sound system, and they blared the sound system so that it would be sort of a noise weapon against the campus protesters. And finally, in that GoFundMe account, they changed the name several times, but one of the names was Bruins for Israel. A Bruin is the mascot of UCLA. So this is the name of the student group on campus that is pro-Israel. And that has been funded by people in the past, like Ackman and like Seinfeld, and also the fellow who funds Canary Mission, Adam Milstein, who's from LA. They all have been funding this activity on campus. Going back even before this, they were funding pro-Israel candidates in student elections at UCLA. So and the other thing to point out about the pro-Israel goons, and I'll call this, by the way, a pogrom that they instigated, is that they are not students. They are the outside agitators. They are the ones who are bringing violence on campus. And their violence enabled the governor of California to send hundreds of police last night onto campus, even though there were, first of all, there was a student protest, but there were 1,000 people outside the student protest supporting them, but who didn't join the encampment itself. So the police were there to arrest all of the campus student protesters. So they exploited the violence, the pro-Israel violence, to repress the pro-Palestine movement on campus. And that's, again, another one of the tactics and the strategy of the pro-Israel lobby.
What do you think, by the way, of, you know, I wanted to ask you about the ADL and Jonathan Greenblatt's comments. I see a lot of people saying, you know, I can't support the ADL anymore because of Greenblatt. And I like to point out, I mean, the ADL has a very checkered history going back many decades. We have the FBI FOIA document showing that they were spying on Arab American students going back to, you know, the 60s even. And we also have the Roy Bullock scandal involving South Africa. I don't think people realize this goes back a long time. And in a lot of ways, I'm not surprised that Greenblatt is throwing his hat in with figures like Mike Johnson and these MAGA people, because I do think there is sort of an alignment. I mean, we see it with Greenblatt and Elon Musk.
Right. So one thing that I think is important to know about Jonathan Greenblatt, which is very rarely spoken. And by the way, this guy earns $1.3 million a year. $1.3 million. I looked it up yesterday, 2 days ago. So he is, I call him a grifter. He is exploiting, quote unquote, his anti-Semitism, his definition of it, in order to gin up hysteria in the American Jewish community and outside of the American Jewish community and MAGA Republicans, like you mentioned. And that enables the ADL to go to its donors who are white, male, and older, because the young generation wants nothing to do with what the ADL stands for. Very, very few young Jews are going to be affiliated with the ADL, and their wealthy fat cat donors are going to eventually die out. And I don't know what the ADL is going to become then. Greenblatt, by the way, will be probably be long gone by then. But the ADL has these very wealthy donors like Ackman, many others. I should do some research into coming up with the names of some of them. But you know the cast: Bernie Marcus, the founder of Home Depot, the Schusterman family, which got their wealth from oil wells in Oklahoma. They all are funding ADL and these Israel lobby groups to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars over the course of years and decades. So that's where Greenblatt has to cater to that coterie, to that group of people. And they in turn fund the ADL. So it's like a feedback loop that Greenblatt makes these outrageous statements about the student protest movement or about anybody who's critical of Israel. And that feeds back to his donors who are happy with what he's doing. And they in turn will funnel money to the ADL. So it's really a vicious circle that really maintains what Greenblatt does and sort of ratifies motivates him to make the statements that he does by calling JVP and calling SJP campus proxies of Hezbollah. He can go back to the billionaires and say, I've done my job to attack and smear the anti-Israel movement, and I'm your sort of your hero, I'm your avatar who goes forward and fights against these forces that you hate. That's what it is.
The last thing I wanted to cover with you, and I hope this isn't too much of a curveball because I didn't mention it in my email to you, but you know, I recently had someone who, you know, I care about them, but they're currently in Ukraine, so they're under a great deal of duress. And they said to me, why do you cover tiny Gaza so much? You don't care enough about Ukraine. And one of the reasons, I would cover Ukraine more, but I'm not as familiar with Eastern Europe, and I hope to rectify that at some point. But you've written quite a few articles about Ukraine. And I think it's important that there, I think there are parallels between the Russo-Ukrainian war and what Israel is doing. And I think there's also a lot of ties between Russia and Israel that often don't get looked at. I was wondering if you could speak to that, because I know a lot of people that think what is happening to Gazans and what is happening to Ukrainians is in no way connected. And in fact, there's some people that want to act like these things are at odds with each other. If you're pro-Ukrainian, you can't be pro-Gazan. I don't think that's true. Can you speak to that issue?
Well, look, there are many parallels between Ukraine and what Russia is doing there and what Israel is doing to Gazans. Ukraine is under, parts of Ukraine are under occupation. Ukraine was invaded by Russia. Israel is occupying Palestine. Israel is committing genocide against the Gazans. And it's basically engaged in war against the Palestinians. So I think we have every reason to support Ukrainians in Ukraine. And I totally support arming Ukraine's congressional appropriation, which, by the way, was stalled by Republicans and not by Democrats or not by progressives. And I support providing those weapons to Ukraine. And I oppose giving the weapons of war, of death, to Israel from the U.S. military arsenal, which we gave $17 billion to do so in the last vote in Congress. So I don't think that there's any contradiction. The difference for me is, first of all, because I'm Jewish and I'm, this is what I write about professionally as a journalist, is Israel. I don't, my cause is not the Ukraine. It doesn't mean I don't support Ukraine. It doesn't mean I don't oppose Putin, who's a thug and a murderer and a war criminal. But there are many, many voices in the United States that support Ukraine. There are many, many fewer voices in the U.S. that support Palestine. So I think for me, at least, that's where my focus has to be. You know, I wouldn't be an expert on Ukraine if I wrote about Ukraine as my sole or as my secondary, you know, focus on what I do. So I give my support where I can and when I can. But, you know, the entire Democratic Party in the United States supports Ukraine. So if the entire Democratic Party in the United States supported Palestine or supported even a two-state solution, I wouldn't need to be doing what I'm doing because there wouldn't be a war anymore. There would be a state of Palestine, I suppose, if I project, which I shouldn't do. But so that's how I would respond to that. The other thing, going back to what you said about Israel, Israel has been co-opted by Russia because many Russian oligarchs are Jewish.
This is what I wanted you to talk about. Yes. Go on.
And so Roman Abramovich and Boris Berezovsky and the names are legion. Oh, I mentioned his name. So many of them left Russia for various reasons, and they came to Israel. And they are now in Israel. And they are now using their billions to invest in Israeli companies. And they've worked their way through the networks in Israel, business networks, and now they are a major, they've been integrated into the Israeli political system and exerting their influence inside Israel. So that's a reason why Israel, by the way, has basically refused to support Ukraine. It's maintained what it calls a neutral position, but it's refused to take Ukrainian refugees, even ones that are Jewish, it's refused to take. It's refused to offer any military aid. It's even refused to offer humanitarian assistance to Ukraine. So it's basically cut off Ukraine.
Even by the way, not to interrupt you, but even Zelensky has sort of noted this. He's like, I don't know why the Israelis aren't helping us. I mean, yeah, you're sort of getting into it, but go on.
That's exactly where I was going to go next. I mean, Zelensky, who is half Jewish, has mentioned, by the way, Zelensky wanted to address the Knesset, and the Knesset wouldn't allow him to do it because they said it would provoke Russia and it would harm our status of neutrality. And Zelensky has noticed it. He's called out Israel about this. So I think that, you know, we have to keep in mind that Israel is Ukraine. And if, I mean, I'm sorry, Israel is Russia. And Netanyahu is Putin, for all intents and purposes in this analogy. And Ukraine is Gaza, or Ukraine is Palestine. We have to, if we're going to talk about this, we have to make sure that that's the framework from which we do so.
I also wanted to add in that regard, I find it very telling that if you look at a figure like, say, Bezalel Smotrich, he talks about the need to denazify all the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. It's the same rhetoric that we see from Russia with regards to denazification. But I digress. Is there anything you want to say in closing? And is there anything you'd want to say? I've always been curious about this because I do have a broad range of listeners, including I've even had listeners that say that they consider themselves liberal or progressive Zionists. What would you want to say to them?
What I would say to them is, this is not a Jewish value. Whatever condemnation you want to offer for what Hamas did on 10/7, if you are not horrified by what's going on in Gaza, you need to get a new prescription for your glasses, or you need to put on your glasses, and you need to be able to see what is going on there. There is no way that anyone who's a liberal Zionist or Jewish liberal Zionist or whatever liberal Zionist should be able to support what's going on in Gaza. And if you can't support what's going on in Gaza, what is your alternative? What is your vision for stopping this? And if you say it's a two-state solution, that is another delusion that the liberal Zionists have, because there is no way Israel refuses a two-state solution. So every U.S. president, every U.S. secretary of state, every foreign leader who talks about getting back to a two-state solution and we need to end the Gaza war in order to create a two-state solution, how are you going to do that? Israel has a stranglehold on not just Gaza, but on the West Bank. So how are you going to get a Palestinian state? Even if you recognize a Palestinian state and you make it a fait accompli for Israel, Israel has a way of making it impossible to have a state. So you have to basically, in some way, force Israel to do that. And the only way is with an outside UN or some outside party, either maybe engaging in sanctions against Israel, economic divestment against Israel, or basically some way forcing them, if the United States would be able to do that with other Israeli allies like the Europeans. And I don't see that happening anytime soon. So any support that you give to Israel of any kind fuels what is happening in Gaza and fuels the movement against a two-state solution. So please, to them, reconsider what you're doing. Do some more reading than whatever you've done. There are plenty of really excellent books about this conflict that will open your eyes. Plenty of movies, plenty of documentaries that will present these this phenomenon in a way that I think reflects reality as opposed to liberal Zionism or the views of the Israel lobby.
And how can my listeners keep up with your work, as always?
Well, the blog is Tikkun Olam. Your URL for the blog is richardsilverstein.com. I also publish somewhat regularly in The New Arab and Middle East Eye. I've got a new piece that's going to come out next week on what's happening on the campuses in Middle East Eye, and also less frequently in Jacobin Magazine. So I would urge my your listeners who are interested to try to follow my blog. You can subscribe to it. And I also gratefully accept donations from people to support my journalism and activism.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed the conversations on this edition of the program. As always, if you appreciate the work here I do at Parallax Views, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. One more time, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.